So I'm drinking today, which is a rarity for me.
I know. I got something for her.
Yes. Betty loves me so much. She purchased Truly Hard Seltzer Rosé.
Yeah. It's pretty good, though, it right?
Is, yeah. It's like drinking water, but also getting boozed up, by the way. I'm Vivian Vega.
Oh, I'm Betty LaRue.
My best buddy over here. Yeah. So we have gotten so many people doing recommendations to us.
Yeah, we have. Thank you guys for sending those in.
It has been blowing up.
So I just read February 14th is when this came out, that there is a transgender woman who has launched the world's first range of specifically designed luxury lingerie for trans women, and that's fucking awesome.
That is awesome.
It's really
especially
cool.
After the whole like Victoria's Secret thing, and yeah, that's great. What's her name? What is it out?
Her name is Carmen Liu. She's 27. She's from London. So they're flattering designed underwear that like tucks the genitals in while featuring pretty bows and laces and trim. It is made for women who are pre-op or who don't plan on doing op, as a way for them to still feel feminine and beautiful and comfortable
And confident.
And confident, yeah, and have that confidence.
Yeah, I really cannot wait to see it.
I was looking at some of them and they're really, it's gorgeous.
Oh my God, and she's a babe.
Yeah, she's a babe.
What in the world?
She's a super hottie.
Hey, Carmen.
So it's just really, really quite beautiful, and it's really important to make people feel confident.
If we can find the
sexy
website, we'll put it on.
Oh yeah, we'll definitely
links and stuff.
That's a great idea. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's a really freaking great idea.
Anyways, I love it. What's your news?
It is for the first time in history, Harvard has 4 Black women faculty deans.
Hey, that's fucking cool.
Yeah. Right.
That's really cool.
Yes. Not only are they women,
yeah,
they're Black women in charge.
Pretty, yeah, know? That's pretty fun, especially at Harvard.
Yeah. In August 2018, Professor Claudine Gay became the latest string of Black women to be appointed dean to dean positions at the university. So that's Professor Claudine Gay. I'm trying to find all the names here. 2016, Michelle Williams, Evelyn Hammonds, it says, before their appointments, Evelyn Hammonds served as the first female and African-American dean for the history of science school for 5 years until 2013. So Evelyn Hammonds, Michelle Williams, Tamiko Brown Najin, and Bridget Terry Long. Okay, so after Evelyn Hammonds left, Bridget Terry Long took her place.
That's pretty awesome.
So, so 4 powerful Black women in charge of, like, an Ivy League school, basically.
Fuck yeah.
I mean,
fuck yeah.
That's pretty fucking cool.
That's amazing. So I'm gonna get started.
Yes.
I was a little buzzed maybe when I started writing this one, and
I'm ready.
I know. I hope you're ready. Okay, so my first woman is Selma Burke.
Good one. My mom recommended her to me.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So she was actually a recommendation. I was really proud of myself. Again, I'd been drinking a little bit. I came up with the title Turnt on a Dime. I like to title things, and there's some controversy and stuff around her, so she's a lot of fun, really cool. So she was born December 31st 1900, by the way. Yeah. In Mooresville, North Carolina, she was the 7th of 10 children.
No, that's too many.
So she grew her passion for, like, sculpting in the clays of the riverbed by her childhood home.
Damn.
Yeah. So the clay was also used to make whitewash for, like, her mom would do for work. And so she would, like, help her mom by collecting the clay and, like, mixing the whitewash.
So it wasn't, like,
stuff.
Red clay? Where is she from?
I don't know how you turn riverbed clay into whitewash. I was not born in the 1900s. I have no clue.
You don't know all of this?
I don't. So she described the feeling of squeezing the clays through her fingers, saying, it was there in 1907 that I discovered me. So though she had a very young interest in art, and that was encouraged by her grandmother, her mother insisted that she get an education and go into a career path that would provide stable income. She decided to go ahead and become a nurse under her mother's instructions.
Right.
And then shortly after her graduation, she married her childhood friend, Durant Woodward, who was a mortician.
Yeah.
I knew you would like that. Do you like how I looked right at you when I
yes.
said it? She married him in 1928, and then he died immediately afterwards of blood poisoning 11 months after their wedding. Yeah. He had blood poisoning.
How? What?
I don't know.
Okay, to be fair, though, mortician work back in those days was
probably hella dangerous.
Yeah, they're like, who the fuck needs safety protection?
In all honesty, washing your hands had just become
like in common the 70s practice. Or 80s, right?
Washing your hands became common practice because there was a outbreak of women that would die after giving birth at this hospital, and that's because they were doing autopsies and then directly delivering babies.
Wrong.
And then
no thanks.
And then some doctor was like, maybe we should wash our hands after touching dead bodies.
You get a raise, sir.
No, he got fucking fired.
Oh god damn it. Please.
So yes, I'm her so mortician. We are way off topic.
We are so.
So off her topic. Mortician husband, he dies of blood poisoning 11 months after their wedding. She then moves to Harlem to work as a private nurse. While there, the art bug burrows its way into her and she becomes part of the Harlem Renaissance. The movement was led by Claude McKay, who from all accounts of their relationship was a real son of a bitch.
Cool.
He was known to destroy her sculptures that he thought were not up to his standards.
Cool.
Because he's a great asshole.
Cool.
Thank goodness this relationship was short-lived, and it did introduce her to many people in the art community. And so that's how kind of her into the art community, and she starts sculpting. So during the 1930s, she taught at the Harlem Community Arts Center. She worked for the Progress Administration on the New Deal Federal Art Project. She traveled to Europe twice. Yeah. And then she had a bust of Booker T. Washington given to the Frederick Douglass High School in Manhattan in 1936. So she said, I believe it's still there. What she's most known for is that she did bas relief portraits.
Bas relief?
B-A-S and then relief. Bas relief.
Bas?
Boss relief. So it's the kind of sculpting where it's against a background. And so it's like you shape it into, like you would get like a piece and like, then you would shape it into like a coin. Okay. So that's what it is. She returned to the United States and enrolled at Columbia University, where she would receive a Master of Fine Arts degree in 1941. With that recognition she gained from her Booker T. Washington bust, she won a competition sponsored by the Fine Arts Commission for the District of Columbia in 1943. And was commissioned to sculpt the president's likeness for the new record of deeds. And this is Roosevelt.
Sweet.
So not finding any good profile pictures for reference, she requested a sit-in with the president and was given 45 minutes. She did her sketches. She said like the sketches were done in like 10 minutes tops, and they just sat and they talked about their childhood. And
what?
And she did her sketches on a paper sack. So just months before Roosevelt's death, Eleanor Roosevelt visited Burke's home in New York to see the profile in progress. And the first lady told her, I think you've made Franklin too young. To which Brooke replied, I didn't make it for today. I made it for tomorrow and tomorrow.
Oh.
I know. I really like that. Like, no, he's not too young. This is a portrait of him that will last forever. It's not a snapshot of him right now. Roosevelt actually died 5 months before the official unveiling of the plaque in 1945. Yeah. But here's the controversy. To honor the former president and his founding of the March of Dimes to combat polio, the U.S. Mint and Congress proposed engraving his portrait on the dime, which at that point held the profile of the goddess Liberty wearing a winged cap. Director Nellie Taylor Rose, the first woman elected governor in Wyoming, by the way, so she hired John R. Sinnock, who is the 8th chief engraver of the United States Mint. So she hires this guy he engraves all of the mints. Yeah, so from 1925 to 1947. But upon the revealing of his design for the dime, it was a shocking resemblance to Burke. And everyone was like, he totally copied exactly what she did. Well, and I want to put the two up side by side. I got on this website looking into this, and it was some dude that was just like, well, it's like the same guy, and he's facing the same direction. But here's the minor differences that definitely make it so he definitely didn't copy her.
That's like when Vanilla Ice took Under Pressure from Queen and David Bowie, and he's like, nuh-uh, because I have a ding-ding.
And a ding-ding at the end.
Fuck off.
Yeah, well, then he shows, he's like, and this isn't the first bias relief that he did of President Roosevelt. Here's the other two that he did. The other two that he did, Roosevelt was facing the other direction, and it had partial, like shoulders and stuff in it. Like, it was a complete, like, why didn't you use the relief you already did? So a few months after she reveals this, you do one that looks exactly like hers, and you had done something that looked, like, completely different before.
Nobody's fallen for it.
No.
But you.
We'll do a side-by-side. side of the two. But then I also want to put the other biases that he had done of Roosevelt and been like, he could have done something other than
like just essentially use your own thing.
Right. So anyways, after many years of controversy and Sinek's complete denial of the accused plagiary, it has been widely accepted that Burke's work was the inspiration and original artwork the dime was designed after, even by the Smithsonian. So suck it.
Take that, dude.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
So Selma Burke died in 1995. At the ripe old age of 95, of 94.
Look, that surprised the drink almost, out of my face.
You almost snorted your Truly.
I totally did.
She was 94 years old and she died of cancer.
So it wasn't even like...
old age. She could have kept ticking if it wasn't for cancer.
What?
She just died in 94.
Listen, Casey, my husband, would call that farm stock. Okay, so basically he says, if you're a salt of the earth, you're going to last.
You're going to last.
A long time. So mine is going to be super short compared to yours because there's not a ton of information on this particular person. And you'll figure out why. My person, her name is Barbara Ross Lee. Barbara was born and raised in the housing projects of Detroit along with her sister. Do you want to take a guess of who Barbara Ross Lee's sister is growing up in Detroit?
In what year?
Oh, it doesn't even say the year she was born. But I'm going to say, if I had to venture a guess, mid-40s.
I don't know.
Diana Ross.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought Diana Ross, but then when it ended with Lee, I was like...
I know.
Threw me off.
I should have said Barbara Ross hyphen Lee. So I don't even know the year she was born or anything. Like, this person is so underrated compared to her sister. Trust me, I think that this woman wanted it this way.
Oh, okay.
She didn't want the fame or anything that her sister had. Now, I will tell you that this woman is leading us to a field trip that we're taking. I had to make sure that it was this one.
I'm getting it on the bus.
Yeah. No, seriously.
I got it from my mom.
I think, what?
You said we're going on a field trip.
Yeah, we are. Oh, you got it. You got a permission form. We're going
to
pack our lunches.
I forged it because I totally forgot to give it to her.
Well, you know, and it's the last day to turn it in.
Right.
So anyways, so Barbara and her sister Diana grew up in the housing projects of Detroit. And then she later attended, so even childhood, I don't know anything about. I guess look up Barbara Ross's childhood or Diana Ross's childhood and you'll know about hers.
And then she had a sister.
She attended Wayne State University for her undergraduate education. So she initially went to Wayne State University for human anatomy and wanted to pursue medicine. But instead, she earned her degree in biology and chemistry in 1965. Cool. So while her sister is, like, becoming Motown's biggest hit, she's like, you know what? Biology and chemistry. I'm going to do that. I'm going to go that path. By herself as a single mother, she attended Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. So while she was a single mom, she did all this, and she graduated with her DO in 1973. After graduating from medical school, she remained in Detroit as a family practitioner. She didn't even really do her osteopathic thing. Then she took a position with the United States Department of Health and Human Services, where she worked on medical education and specifically for people of color in medicine.
That's fucking awesome.
Right?
That's really good.
Yeah. She was the first osteopathic physician to receive the Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellowship. I don't know what it is. I don't know how big of a deal it is, because I am not a doctor. Not a doctor. That's Winston's favorite part of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Then it hops all the way to 1993. She's still alive, by the way. Still practicing.
She's still practicing? Cool.
Yeah, well, so she's practicing, but she's also... you'll gotta get to this. In 1973, she was appointed dean of the Heritage College. So this is where that news that I brought up goes with my person. That's cool. So she was appointed dean of the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine at Ohio University, so down in Athens. And she held that position until 2001. She was known, during her tenure, she was known for innovating the curriculum. So she just completely changed it up. She's like, after she left Heritage College, she became the Vice President of Health Services and Medical Affairs at the New York Institute of Technology. That was in 2002. She became the Dean of its New York College of Osteopathic Medicine. I don't know what's going on with her now. It doesn't say she's not still there, so she may be in New York. So either way, let's go visit her.
Yeah, let's go say hi.
Let's go say hi. So here's where our field trip comes in. She was inducted into the Ohio Women's Hall of Fame in 1998.
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay, we should go.
Yeah.
Great. And she's an honorary doctorate of science from the New York Institute of Technology. And she's a member of several different committees regarding research on women's health, committee on rural health, and the board of family physicians. She got the Distinguished Public Service Award from Oklahoma State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. And it's short but sweet, but there is Barbara Ross Lee, the sister of Miss Diana Ross, stopping in the name of love. All right, you're next.
Okay, I am next.
My next one, I have like 5 pages worth of stuff.
My next one is really long and very jumbled, but the one I'm doing, it makes perfect sense.
Hey, you're
sense.
The editor.
Yeah, I know. But the one I'm doing, like, it makes perfect sense for it to be a little, like...
A little long and jumbled?
Jumbly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I am doing Marsha P. Johnson.
Yes.
And what's that P stand for, ladies and gentlemen? Pay it no mind.
What? Really?
Yeah, that's what she...
No!
So she would always... She said, I'm Marsha P. Johnson. And when people would be like, what's the P stand for? She'd say, pay it no mind.
Love that.
The same thing she would say to people when they asked her about her gender. Pay it no mind. She's born Malcolm Michaels Jr. on August 24th, 1945 in Elizabeth, New Jersey. She was one of 6 children of Malcolm Michaels Sr. and Alberta Claiborne. And I only bring up her birth name because in many accounts, she would still go by both. Dressing as Malcolm and Marshall with their respective personalities. You read about it and they're like, oh, it was classic schizophrenia.
Mm.
But, and this is me just interjecting. I also think that it was a symptom of the time.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, you know, she...
you can't be that... You
can't be that woman all the time.
Right, right, right.
And so I don't think it was so much like she would... And whenever she would be Malcolm would be more... violent and angry and physical. And I think that it was like certain times in your life, she had to be Malcolm and she wasn't allowed to be Marsha. And so, yeah. So it says that she went back and forth, but I don't think it has anything to do with personally. And again, I didn't know her and I didn't see her as both, but to me, I think it speaks more of the time that she couldn't be Marsha all the time.
Right, right.
She was a activist. She was a trans rights activist. She was a AIDS epidemic activist. She was HIV positive. She was a sex worker. She did a lot. So Marsha P. Johnson was celebrating her 25th birthday at Stonewall during the early morning hours of June 28th, 1969, when the police began a raid of Stonewall under the guise of busting the establishment for selling liquor without a license. At the time, it was standard procedure for the police officers to lead women in the club to the bathroom to verify their sexes.
No!
Yes. Arrest anyone that wasn't dressed to their gender norm during these raids. And the police were also... well known for sexually assaulting lesbian patrons during these raids as well. Anyways, at this point, a crowd of sympathizers had begun gathering outside the inn, and they watched as employees and drag queens were dragged outside, violently handcuffed by the police before being shoved into police cars. And then a police officer clubbed a butch-dressed lesbian named Stormy De Laverine over the head, when she said that her handcuffs were too tight.
Cool.
And that's when the violent riot broke out and the crowd exploded. There are so many accounts, and because of the time and because they would be thrown into jail constantly for this type of thing, there's different accounts as to what happened, but there is a common thought that Marsha P. Johnson, like, threw a brick at the police officers, and that's what really started the riots. Yeah, and it was thought that it was Marsha. Now, there's claims that, you know, like, she was like, I wasn't even there that night. But, of course, there's claims that you weren't even there. You're like, there was so much, like, people getting arrested and all of that. She was definitely there, and many people said that she threw the first brick. And the reason that that rings true is because she had a prior conviction for hitting police officers with her handbag that had 2 bricks in it. So, I mean, like, it's kind of her M.O. So, I mean, it's very foggy. Like, the whole riot, I'm sure, like, a lot of things
so were... much is going on. That's why they call it a riot.
Exactly.
You don't know.
And then on top of that, people are, you know, changing their stories because they don't want to be arrested or, you know, like, that sort of thing. So she was one of the first patrons to resist the police that night. Her and Sylvia Rivera were among the first in the crowd of onlookers to take action by throwing, and Sylvia Rivera, who was, like, her best friend, if you see pictures of them at the front of, like, the Pride Parade, it's her and Sylvia Rivera. And Sylvia, who is also another trans woman, she threw her bottle at the police. And then the riots, they helped catalyze spread the surrounding neighborhoods until New York was in an uproar. So that was, you know,
fucking fight the power, man.
Fuck yeah. That's and you know, as many people know, I hope as many people know, that was the start of the gay pride is Stonewall.
Stonewall.
Yeah. So, and what started in Stonewall? Sylvia and Marsha were there. 1 year after the riots, the first gay pride parade were held. In 2 years, there were gay rights groups in every major city in America. And so right after Stonewall, and I'm using the name, like, I'm actually using the names, we don't call it this anymore, but after Stonewall, Sylvia and Marsha formed STAR, which was Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. And what that was, and of course we would say transgender now, mm-hmm. but
right.
It's not a correct term, and I'm not going to change what they said back in the day, but of course. Transvestites suggest that they find some sort of sexual pleasure as dressing as women, when in actuality, they're transgender.
Right.
But there wasn't that wasn't covered with anything. Right. So it was a gay, gender nonconforming, and transgender street activist organization founded in 1970. So, and they were famous for in New York City for helping drag queens of color. Wow. It was a radical political collective.
What year was this?
1970. Right after Stonewall. Because that was 69.
It blew up after that.
Yeah. Well, sure. It was just the two of, essentially, but here's what STAR was. STAR was Sylvia and Marsha saying, there are so many non-gender conforming sex workers and street people is what they would called themselves.
Right.
And it gave them a home. They literally bought a building and housed these people that no one else would house.
That's really cool.
And helped these people that no one else. And it gets sadder. So they were the mothers. They did intersectional politics and supported some of the most vulnerable members of the community. They were there to support those people. And they were the mothers of the household and funded the organization largely through sex work, because they were both sex workers. STAR is considered by many to be a groundbreaking organization in the queer liberation movement and a model for other organizations because, and this is where it gets kind of sad, because they weren't covered by the gay community. They weren't supported by the gay community at all. And when I say at all, in 1973, both Johnson and Rivera were banned from participating in the gay pride parade by a gay and lesbian committee who were administrating the event, stating they weren't going to allow drag queens at their marches, claiming they were giving them a bad name.
What?
They were banned from gay pride.
Oy.
That's what I'm, like, these women fought to help.
They, like, started it.
Yeah.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. In 1973, y'all, they were banned.
Do better.
You know what their response was? They marched ahead of the parade.
Good.
And that's, you see that picture a lot. That's the picture I'm talking about. And there's a really beautiful painting of it, too. So during the gay rights rally in New York in City Hall in the 1970s, and they were photographed by Dana Davies, a reporter asked Johnson why the group was demonstrating, and Johnson shouted into the microphone, "Darling, I want my gay rights now."
Damn straight.
And there's video of her doing it. It's, like, amazing.
She's like, I'm going to try to be sweet still, but, like, I'm going to also, like, shove it seriously up your ass. Like, fuck off.
Shortly after that, they felt really just kind of beaten down, and they didn't have any money, and they literally were supporting this foundation through prostitution, and it closed down. STAR closed down. But Johnson continued to be a huge activist and into the 80s, huge activist on the AIDS epidemic during the 80s. She was, for the majority of her life, without a home. She was homeless. She spent the last years of her life living with a friend who had told her it was, like, negative 10 degrees outside. And he was like, you have got to come inside. You cannot stay outside. But that was the gay community. That was the community that she had built, too. Is they would just live in households that were families because they didn't have anything.
Right.
No one else except. And shortly after the 1992 Pride Parade. So 1992, right after the Pride Parade, Johnson's body was discovered floating in the Hudson River. Police initially ruled the death a suicide. But Johnson's friends and members of the local community insisted that she was not suicidal, noted that the back of Johnson's head had a massive wound. But the police were just like...
They're just going to overlook that.
Yeah. Because no, she's not important because she is a marginalized human being.
Yes.
She's not going to make headlines. She's not important for us to investigate. We're going to investigate
someone. Too bad. Yes, she is.
Yeah. So in November of 2012, activist Maria Lopez succeeded in getting New York Police Department to reopen the case as a possible homicide.
Woo!
So there's lots of different theories, and this was it's on Netflix right now. It's called The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, and it's following a woman who works in the gay community, and she fights for trans rights and for trans people to get their day in court, essentially, so, like, that they're not forgotten,
mm-hmm.
And that, you know, like, their murders aren't, because they're also more likely to be murdered.
Yeah.
And so...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. It follows her investigating Marsha P. Johnson's murder, and there's all these questions, and they're like, she didn't commit suicide. And Sylvia says, she would have never committed suicide. Her and I had a promise to each other that we would cross the River Jordan together. On top of there being the death and life of Marsha P. Johnson, there's also Pay It No Mind, The Life and Times of Marsha P. Johnson, and Happy Birthday, Marsha, which was done by Rena Gossett, another trans black woman.
Nice.
So yeah, so she's got three like documentaries about her, which actually Happy Birthday, Marsha she's a fictional character, but it's about her.
It's based
on her. And she appears as a fictional character in two film dramas that are based on real events, including Stonewall that came out in 2015, and then Happy Birthday, Marsha, where she is played by Maya Taylor, who, Maya Taylor, is a black trans actress who has gotten a lot of notification. So it's pretty awesome. And that's, again, inspired by the Stonewall Uprising. But it's really amazing. Like I said, women like Marsha P. Johnson are the reason why women like the one I mentioned earlier today are getting to do these
things.
Oh, with
the lingerie line.
With the lingerie line.
Carmen.
Carmen, yeah. She put forth so much, and she is a name that everyone should know. She is a name that everyone should think about. She is the T in LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
She fought for that to be there, and she was shunned because it wasn't pretty. It seemed messy to the gays at that time to include trans people.
What?
You know, and because they were so busy fighting for their rights, they couldn't include.
It's just like the feminists who are only white. Girl feminist.
Yeah.
You know, you have to include, if you want to be that, you have to include it all.
You have to include everyone. You have to include it all.
The men that are in
this. Just the idea that they were fucking, like, banned from.
That's insane.
Right? I got so angry. In the interview, of Sylvia, it shows video of her actually getting up in, like, 1973 onto the stage and being booed, and her being like, we have a house full of, you know, like, people that we've taken off the streets that need you, and they are your brothers, and they are your sisters, and it's, like, heartbreaking. Mm. And also, she was known for being, I think somebody referred to as the Rosa Parks of the LGBT movement.
For sure.
And I love that.
Yeah, for sure.
And then she was known for always being extra. There were always flowers in her hair, and her outfits were always bright.
Is the picture I saw of her with the hat and the flowers? Had, like, a hat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, like, that is Marsha P. Johnson. Like, she is just constantly that, like, and everyone said that she was everyone's mother. She would just take care of you.
She looked like it. Well, I guess we're going to move on to Diane Carroll, who has literally no danger, we'll say.
No danger.
There's no danger with this woman.
This is my second, like, unsolved murder.
Yeah. The first one, we're still going to go with, like, a gorilla, though. I am doing Diane Carroll. Have you ever heard of her?
No.
Okay, I hadn't either, and being who I am, I'm so mad at myself for not knowing who the fuck this is.
Okay, I'm super listening.
Okay, so Diane Carroll was born Carol Diane Johnson.
Ah!
I wonder why she switched it. And it's spelled D-I-A-H-A-N-N.
Really? I like that, Diane. Oh my god, she's so gorgeous!
I know.
Her face is like a fucking Barbie doll. And this is her now. Holy shit!
Don't you want to just punch her in her cute ass face?
Oh my god! She's gorgeous!
I know, it's stupid.
Her face looks like someone designed it.
And look at her smiling, like, get out!
Shut up!
Get Anyway, I know, she's beautiful. She was born July 17th, 1935. She is an American actress, singer, and model. Triple threat is what most would say.
That's a triple threat.
Okay, so she rose to stardom in some of the earliest major film studio films to feature black casts, including Carmen Jones in 1954, Porgy and Bess in 1959, and later on, she will be nominated for a Tony Award for Best Actress in for a black woman in her role in the Broadway show No Strings Attached.
Ooh.
So she was the very first black woman nominated for a Tony.
That's cool.
And that was in 1962.
God, that took too long.
So she was born in the Bronx in New York City to John Johnson and Mabel. I love that name.
Mabel. It's really cute.
And Mabel Fault. Both of whom were from the Carolinas. One from South, one from North. And they, when she was an infant, they moved to Harlem, where she grew up. So she attended a music and arts high school with the most random fucking person. That's okay. Also a black person who got moderately famous. Not as famous, I would say, as maybe her, but still, nonetheless, to nerds especially, very famous. Do you want to guess?
Cora?
No.
I don't know who.
Okay. Billy Dee Williams. Star Wars. But anyways, I thought that was really random. Like, her and Billy Dee Williams went to school together. It's like Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond. Oh, yeah.
But, like, the black version. She recalls her parents being supportive and enrolling her in dance and singing and modeling classes. So by the time she was 15, she was modeling for Ebony.
Which fuck was, yeah, like, she was.
New.
Yeah. New it would have been super new. But yeah. Also, fuck yeah, she was.
So after high school, she attended New York University, majoring in sociology.
Really?
Yeah.
Just like random. Just like, okay.
Yeah. So she got her big break at 18. So right when she enrolled in New York University, basically. When she appeared on, basically, at the time, it was The Voice or American Idol or America's Got Talent.
What was it called?
It was called Chance of a Lifetime. It says she won $1,000 as the top prize for the rendition of the Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein, Why Was I Born?
That sounds like a terribly sad song.
I know. She went on to win the following 4 weeks. Later, she got asked to do Manhattan's Cafe Society and Latin Quarter nightclubs as extended stays. Since she was in New York, they were like, well, since you're here, just perform at these nightclubs. Sing.
Sounds good.
Basically a cabaret singer.
Love it.
In 1962, Carol won the Tony Award for Best Actress, a first for a black woman.
Hell yeah. So she had the first, she had the first nomination and the very first win.
Yep.
That's fucking awesome.
Exactly right.
Kicking ass.
Yep.
Taking names.
For the role of Barbara Woodruff in Samuel L. Taylor and Richard Rodgers' musical No String. But she's most well known for her title role in the 1968 television series Julia, which made her the very first African-American actress to star in her own television series, where she did not play a domestic worker.
Fuck yeah.
That role won her the Golden Globe Award for Best Actress in a Television Series in 1968. And it got her a nomination for an Emmy Award in 1969. Some of her earlier work included appearances on shows hosted by Jack Parr, Merv Griffin, Johnny Carson, Judy Garland, and Ed Sullivan. She received an Academy Award for Best Actress nomination for the 1974 film Claudine. She was also on the Hollywood Palace. I don't know much about it, but this is what that picture's from. So obviously it's a big deal because Sammy Davis Jr. is on it.
There's Sammy Davis Jr.
It's 1968. It's kind of like, I guess, a big deal. However, in 1984, this is where I would have known her because this is my mom's jam.
Got it.
1984, Carol joined the nighttime soap opera Dynasty.
Okay, so I'm not going to lie. I want to start watching Dynasty.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds exactly right up your alley. So in Dynasty, she played the jet set diva named Dominique Devereaux. She's the half-sister of Blake Carrington. And her high-profile role in Dynasty also reunited her with schoolmate Billy Dee Williams, who played her on-screen husband briefly named Brady Lloyd.
Really?
Yeah.
So they ended up playing husband and wife together? That's hysterical.
Yeah. Carol has been married 4 times.
Okay.
First was a record producer, Monty Kay, in 1956. Mm-hmm. Interesting fact, her father boycotted the wedding ceremony.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm. So the marriage ended in 1962, so we must have known something. The union produced a daughter, Suzanne K. Bamford, who is now a media freelance journalist. In 1959, Carol began a 9-year affair with the married actor Sidney Poitier.
Ooh, 9-year affair?
He persuaded her to divorce her husband, and he would leave his wife to be with her. When Carol got her divorce, Poitier did not keep up his end of the bargain.
That son of a bitch!
Yet!
And then she fucking slapped him.
The relationship continued till 68.
Motherfucker! That was before she started in Dynasty. She didn't have that slap ready yet.
No, she did not. She had not practiced it. Carol then got engaged to British television host and producer David Frost from 70 to 73. But in 73, Carol surprised the press by marrying Las Vegas boutique owner Fred Glusman.
So wait, she was engaged with one guy.
Yep.
And
yep.
I was like, psych, I'm actually marrying this guy.
Just kidding. I'm going to go for this Las Vegas boutique owner. But it's cool because several weeks later, she filed for divorce, charging that Glusman was physically abusive.
Oh.
Yeah. In 1975, Carol married Robert DeLeon, a managing editor of Jet magazine. Unfortunately, she was widowed 2 years later when DeLeon was killed in a car crash.
Is that irony? The owner of Jet magazine
was killed in a car
crash. Mike is gonna say no. Anytime I think something is irony, it's absolutely not irony. It would be irony if he died in a jet crash, I think.
Carol's fourth marriage was to singer Vic Damone in 1987. The union, in which Carol admitted was turbulent, had legal separation in 1991. Carol was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1997.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Not those
she's still alive, though.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She underwent 9 weeks of radiation therapy and has been clear since.
Good.
Yep.
She's like, a fuck you, breast cancer.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's that look right there. She frequently...
I'm sorry, I found another gif of her. By the way, guys, there are really great gifs.
Yeah. She frequently speaks on the need for early detection and prevention of the disease. She was supposed to return to the stage, Broadway stage, in 2014 in a revival of A Raisin in the Sun as Mama, but withdrew prior to opening, citing the demands of the rehearsal and performance schedule. I assume because she still probably wasn't 100%.
Right, she had just got out of probably chemo and stuff, which...
Right.
That's really rough.
She is also charitable. She is a founding member of the Celebrity Action Council, which is a volunteer group of celebrity women who serve the women's outreach of the Los Angeles Mission, working with women in rehabilitation from problems with drugs, alcohol, and prostitution.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes. She helped form the group along with other female television personalities, including Mary Fran, Donna Mills, Linda Gray, and Joan Van Ark. She also, there's a documentary about her called Diane Carroll, the Lady, the Music, the Legend. 1969, she won a Golden Globe Award for Best TV Star Female in Julia. And in 2011, she was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame. So that is Diane Carroll, the babiest babe of all bitch slaps.
Dude, yeah, she is. If you ever need a gift
for a slap,
that's where to go. Are we ready to talk about our women that we know that are fucking badass?
The most ready.
The most ready. Okay, so my woman this month is going to be the... utterly fucking gorgeous.
On the level, I would say, of Diane Carroll.
She's just too fucking beautiful.
Her face is so sharp.
It is.
Yeah.
Is the beautiful... She's an actual trained dancer, and she's an amazing dancer, and she...
Who is she? Tell
us! Oh my god, it's Pandora Fox!
Yes, it is.
Oh my god, she's so beautiful. But she is a performer, she is a burlesque performer, and a producer, and one part of Fox Airs. Productions.
Yes.
She is Crimson Lace Cabaret. She is
Panache Toi.
She recently won the crown. She is Miss OGP Femme 2019 at the Ohio Gay Pride Pageantry.
I was so close, damn it.
She's also, on a personal level, one of those mama types.
Oh,
she's
100%.
100% a mama type.
Always has. You know what's the greatest, though? Is sometimes to shows she will bring her actual mama.
Oh, she does! And it's so...
And they bring food. They bring snacks for everyone.
And no matter how busy Pandora is, she's always has time to take someone under her wing.
And she's always, like, drinking champagne or wine.
Oh,
like,
my God. She's always so classy.
She's always
drinking wine. No matter what bar she is, she finds that one bottle of wine that they've had on the shelves for forever, and she gets them to open it up for her. Also, she loves gin, just as I love gin.
Ugh.
And she is a fellow three-ring binder lover.
Okay, well, to be fair, who the fuck doesn't love three-ring
binders? A good three-ring binder. But no, she's an amazing human being and just a fantastic performer. She's been performing in Columbus for years. She's getting her recognition that she deserves. If you have a chance, look up Pandora Fox. Look at her work.
Yeah.
So that's my person of the month. The fucking flamboyant, fabulous, fierce Pandora fucking Fox.
Yes, I love her.
I love her so much.
My person is also a quick friend. She's her name is Deborah Shade.
And I have her book.
That's exactly what I was going to talk about. She is a writer. Maybe She's Right.
Plus, you can find her book on Amazon, BT yes, Dubs.
It's on Amazon. Maybe She's Right. And I'll tell you what it's about. Maybe She's okay. Right. From the heart of a sex addict, a story unfolds that will keep you turning page after page and taking a few of her experiences into your bedroom. So it's like a very sex positive thing. She also hosts classes, consensual sex practices, and she gives consensual sex like lessons. She teaches you how to deal with consent, how to ask for consent, how to go about making people feel safe in the bedroom. If you don't know one another, it's hard.
I love that she teaches how to ask for consent.
Yes. So at Trauma this past year, we had to take a consent class.
Which is awesome.
As performers, they wanted us to be kind of the front line.
Yeah, that's great.
And she, you know, helped oversee that. She basically had the whole basement of Trauma, which is a big event here in Columbus. And she taught classes on how to ask permission. It's a simple fucking concept. Anyways, I'm not going to get angry about it. She also hosts...
it is a simple fucking concept, but...
People don't know it.
They don't know the concept. They were never taught the concept. And asking for what you want. Well, saying no is really hard and we're taught not to do it, especially as women.
Yes.
Asking for consent means being open and honest about your sexuality, which is also another thing that people are told not to do.
Yes.
And so it literally...
Which is ridiculous.
It's the stupidest shit. It's so dumb. It's stupid that we have to have classes on it, but we have to have classes on it because we've literally done everything we can to tell people not to talk about
yes,
it.
Yes.
We've
so she last thing, most recent events, she has this thing called Adult Recess, which mm-hmm. is again consensual. Sometimes couples come, you know, like a swinger type thing. But she has an adult recess also, which is a paint night where you get to paint on nude models.
That's fun.
And she also does a wine and paint of nude models. So it's like...
That's so fun.
It's like those art paint night, like the wine and canvases, but you're painting a nude model.
Nude people.
Not only teaches you the consent aspect, but also that every body is perfect. Every body is a piece of art, you know? Every single body deserves
where does
love
she do you know where she does those is she doing that at
Vandarelli room? No, okay, maybe, I think I could be wrong about that. You'll have to look that up. Let me see,
we can look it up and we'll put it in the thing. I thought it sounded very Vandarelli room.
Either way, I've had a lot of friends volunteer as her models, and everything I've ever seen of the work there has been beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Absolutely beautiful. Fun. So, Deborah Shade, author, sex advocate, consent advocate, and artist.
That's awesome.
Is my person.
Awesome. And you can buy her book on Amazon.
On Amazon.
All right, ladies. So, and gentlemen, thanks guys again for sending us.
Oh, and I have a correction. Real quick, let me tell
you. Oh, yeah,
it
yeah, absolutely.
Miss Becky, your sister, actually, emailed in about when I did Bette Midler, and I had said Ivanka Trump, but I meant Ivana Trump, which is so easy to get confused.
You know who's you know what's funny? Honey Merlot also mentioned that.
I'm telling you, honestly, I meant Ivana, and I know I meant the mom, but for some reason Ivanka came out, and I apologize.
That's an easy one. Trump does
There's
it all the time.
There's one little letter...
Ew.
Okay, well, that being said, please submit your requests for who you want us to talk about on the podcast, either to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, email. We'll post it all in the links.
Remember to like and rate us on iTunes. It helps. It helps.
It really, really helps.
Remember to keep smearing lipstick.
And raisin hell.
Bye-bye.
Bye.